Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is the Troubles Podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. This episode is going to be a bit different from the other ones, as it is an attempt to give a basic introduction to how England ended up in Ireland, and the centuries leading up to the conflict which became known as the Troubles. As well as that, I will explain the different paramilitary organisations involved and the various splinter groups that emerged during the conflict and the ones that are still active today. I'll then spend some time talking about the Good Friday Agreement and how it brought an end to the violence, restoring a tentative peace to the area. Because this episode will be a little bit longer than most episodes, if you're looking for something specific, please check out the show notes for the timestamps of when I'll talk about them. We'll begin with the background as to how England ended up in Ireland in the first place. In the 12th century, Ireland was inhabited by a number of lords and high kings who were constantly fighting each other for territory. Dermot McMurrogh was the king of the province of Leinster at the time, but was ousted by Rory O'Connor and Tiernan O'Rourke. McMurrogh fled Ireland, but wanted to take back his throne, and sought help from the English king, Henry II. Henry allowed him to recruit Norman mercenaries in exchange for swearing an oath of loyalty to him. Dermot and the Norman men returned to Ireland in what was considered the first time English forces entered the country. They joined up with Dermot's army and helped him recapture a significant portion of Ireland. Just to be clear, this is a very brief overview of what happened in the era. If you're interested, please look into it, there's some very detailed accounts. Dermot also offered his daughter Aoife's hand in marriage to Strongbow, who was one of the Normans who came over from England. With this marriage, Strongbow would have succession to the throne of Ireland upon Dermot's death. Henry II didn't like Strongbow's growing power and influence in Ireland, and was afraid Strongbow might amass an army and then try and take England next. So, in 1171, Henry invaded Ireland and took control, naming part of Ireland as the Lordship of Ireland. He didn't control the entire island, and there were still large areas of Ireland under the control of the native Irish. Over the next 300 years, the Norman influence grew weaker and weaker for two reasons. For one, the Normans were distracted with the War of the Roses, which was a series of civil wars going on in England. As well as that, the Black Plague hit Europe and had a much greater effect on the Normans living in Ireland than the native Irish themselves, as the Normans mostly lived close together in towns, and the disease spread quickly. The native Irish lived out in the country, and because of this were less susceptible to getting and spreading plague. Soon, the Normans had completely lost their foothold in Ireland, and only had control of Dublin and the surrounding area, which was known as the Pale. In 1536, King Henry VIII of England decided to recapture Ireland, as he didn't want it to become a base for future rebellions or foreign invasions of England. He invaded Ireland, and by 1603, Ireland was completely under control of the English monarchy and was known as the Kingdom of Ireland. Prior to this, King Henry had begun his quest to leave the Catholic Church behind. England had been Catholic, and the Pope at the time, Pope Clement III, refused to annul King Henry's marriage so he could marry another woman to have a son and heir to the throne. Because of this, King Henry decided to separate the Church of England from the Pope, and the United Kingdom became entirely Protestant. Ireland and the native Irish were a heavily Catholic country, and England was unsuccessful in their attempts to convert the people. The native Irish resented being ruled by a Protestant monarch and staged multiple rebellions, which were often violently quashed. This heightened resentment of English rule in Ireland, which was only going to get worse. From 1556 AD to 1620 AD, the English government tried a new tactic to get Ireland into line: plantations. They believed that if they confiscated the land from Irish Catholic landowners and gave it to Scottish and English Protestants, they could stamp out the insubordination and imprint an English identity on Ireland. In this way, thousands of planters were pumped into Ireland and given fertile patches of land that were taken from the native Irish. The demography of Ireland changed, and because of their newly inherited wealth, the British in Ireland made their way into the ruling class, which represented English and Scottish interests first. Many of these plantations were failures, as the native Irish fought back, but the one that occurred in Ulster, in the north of Ireland, was a success. The planters settled in the area and over the years became a majority population. This was particularly poignant because prior to this plantation, Ulster was the most Gaelic part of Ireland, and the province was completely outside of the control of the English. The new English and Scottish settlers were also not allowed to hire any Irish to work on their land, and had to import English or Scottish people over if they wanted labourers. In this way, the settler population in Ulster increased rapidly. The Irish Catholics were still there, but they had little to no power or land. Though the plantations in the rest of the country were not as successful, England still had control over the island of Ireland and defeated any rebellions that occurred over the next few hundred years. In the mid-1800s, the poor Irish relied on one crop, the potato. It was resilient and would grow on the smallest patch of land. When a disease known as blight struck the potato, it led to a famine that would kill and displace millions of Irish people. The population of Ireland before the famine was 8 million, which dropped to 4.4 million in the years after, because so many Irish people died or were forced to leave the country in search of a better life. There is an argument among nationalists that Britain is responsible for the famine in Ireland, not for the disease itself, but rather for their response when Irish people started to die. A small group of about 10,000 English families owned practically all the farmland in Ireland, and an enormous amount of food was being shipped out of Ireland and sold throughout the famine. In some cases, the food was exported on the same ships that the starving Irish were passengers on as they fled Ireland in search of food. The English government's response to the famine in Ireland was to let Ireland deal with it, and they were very slow to offer any form of tangible aid, although they were in control of the country at the time. After a war of independence against the British in 1919 and a civil war in 1922, Ireland eventually became a republic in 1937. But because there was an English majority in six counties in Northern Ireland from the plantation hundreds of years before, those counties remained part of the United Kingdom. Now we will move into the more recent history, from the 1950s and 60s onwards, and what is considered the start of the period known as the Troubles. Ireland was now split into the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland was composed of both native Irish Catholics and Protestant settlers from England and Scotland. Though hundreds of years had passed, there was still a massive wealth disparity between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. Catholics languished in rural poverty, and the number of unemployed Catholics was massive compared to unemployed Protestants. This divide led to a lot of violence and protesting, as the native Irish demanded to have the same civil liberties as the Protestants. Northern Ireland at this time was completely controlled by Unionists, and there was a number of policies put in place so that the status quo remained. Brian Feeney explains in his book The Troubles some of these policies. For one, if anyone wanted to take up a publicly paid job, such as teacher, police officer, civil servant, or government official, then they would need to swear an oath of allegiance to the British Crown, something which the Nationalists refused to do. Local government was also firmly in control of the Unionists, and they were able to ensure that Nationalists never gained control of any council. An example of this was in the city of Derry, which had an overwhelmingly Nationalist majority, but only had Unionist mayors there between 1922 and 1972. For a large part of the 20th century, Northern Ireland was described as having a Protestant parliament for a Protestant people, and the Catholics were left with no support and with no representation. By the 1960s, things were changing. Free education for all had been introduced into the country, which allowed Catholics to get a second and third level education, and many were fed up being treated as second class citizens. Catholics made up 35% of the population of Northern Ireland, and this number was increasing, so they couldn't be frozen out of council and government forever. In 1963, Terence O'Neill became the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland. O'Neill was a Unionist, but unlike his predecessors, he was committed to ending the sectarianism in Northern Ireland. He began visiting Catholic schools, and he also started a discourse with the Catholic community, a move which upset many Unionists. The loudest voice of opposition to O'Neill's policies belongs to Reverend Ian Paisley. Paisley was a staunch Unionist and wanted nothing to do with the Nationalists. He was an exceptional orator, and thousands would gather when he spoke. He would organise marches to protest any sign that the Unionist government was conceding to the Catholics. One such example was when the Union Jack flag at Belfast City Hall was lowered to half-mast to mark the death of Pope John XIII, as a mark of respect to the Catholic population. Paisley was outraged by this and organised a march with 1,000 protesters, all waving Union Jack flags. This new wave of educated Catholics began to publish statistics on unemployment, job discrimination, and electoral gerrymandering, and soon MPs in England began to take notice. In particular, Labour MPs, who had a large amount of Irish people living in England in their jurisdiction. In 1966, a general election in the United Kingdom was called. As part of the United Kingdom, Northern Ireland had 12 seats at the British Parliament, all of which had been traditionally filled by Unionists. The area of West Belfast was densely packed with Catholics, who realised that there was a chance they could win that seat, and a campaign began, with the intention of electing Labour Party member and Nationalist Gerry Fitt. As part of this campaign, a tricolour flag was placed in the window of the Irish Republican Party offices in Belfast, a move which upset Unionists who didn't agree with having an Irish flag on display in Northern Ireland. Paisley organised a march where they would remove the flag, but the Northern Irish Police Force, the RUC, stepped in and smashed their way into the office and removed the flag. It's important to remember that the RUC were 90% Protestant at the time, and considered to be in bed with the Unionists. These actions caused huge unrest in the area, with Catholics appalled at the actions of the Unionists and the police force, leading to what became known as the Divis Street Riots. A lot of young nationalists also saw for the first time the RUC in full riot gear attacking Catholic civilians, and the seeds of mistrust in the police force were firmly planted. Gerry Fitt was successful in his campaign and became the first nationalist politician to be elected into government, and was able to bring issues in Northern Ireland to the forefront of political debate in England. In 1967, the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, or NICRA, was formed. Based heavily on the civil rights movement in America, the group organised a number of peaceful marches protesting housing conditions and living conditions that many Catholics faced. Though Unionists initially joined the group, the IRA and Sinn Féin presence grew within the organisation, and it soon became primarily Catholic. Whenever they would organise marches, Ian Paisley would organise counter-marches that would often turn violent. Then, in 1968, the RUC attacked another NICRA march. Gerry Fitt was there, as well as a number of English politicians and the media. The footage that emerged from this attack depicted the Northern Irish police force attacking unarmed Catholics. This footage would be broadcast all over the world, and is widely considered as the point of no return for the Troubles in Northern Ireland. 1 year later, in 1969, a Protestant society known as the Apprentice Boys staged a march in the city of Derry, which was 60% Catholic. The Apprentice Boys March is an annual march that passes along the city walls of Derry to commemorate the 1689 siege of Derry, in which the Protestants resisted a Catholic siege of the city. The march was considered highly provocative to Catholics, as tensions were very high at the time, and the Apprentice Boys marched directly by the Bogside area of Derry, where the Catholics lived. Violence soon erupted as Catholic civilians faced off against the RUC and Loyalists. The RUC entered the Bogside in full riot gear and fired tear gas and water cannons at the Catholics, who responded with petrol bombs and rocks. This became known as the Battle of the Bogside. The rioting lasted for 2 days, and was so intense that it prompted the Irish Taoiseach, or Prime Minister at the time, Jack Lynch, to say that he could not stand by and watch innocent people injured, and perhaps worse. He promised to send the Irish army up to the border to set up a field hospital for those injured in the fighting. Unionists perceived this as a threat that the Irish army would invade Northern Ireland and were appalled. 2 days later, things had not improved. Most of the civilians in the Bogside had mobilised and were facing off against the RUC, Loyalists and the B Specials, who were a quasi-military force that had no training in crowd control. Things were reaching a boiling point. With no other options available, the Northern Irish Prime Minister, James Chichester Clark, requested that British troops be sent to Derry. This would mark the first time that the British Army had entered Ireland since partition, and the country would be directly ruled by the United Kingdom. The troops came in and were initially welcomed by Catholics, who thought that they would be a good neutral force when compared against the biased RUC. It wouldn't be long before the troops were soon considered as bad, if not worse, than the RUC. The Battle of the Bogside is widely considered to be the first major confrontation that marked the beginning of the Troubles. I will now be explaining the different paramilitary organisations, armed forces and political parties that were involved in the Troubles. It was not really a case of two sides facing each other, as there were many different groups with many different ideologies for the country. I'll explain a number of the groups here, starting with the armed forces. The main police force in Northern Ireland were the RUC, who were seen as a unionist police force and were often heavy-handed against Catholics. They were reformed and renamed in 2001 as the Police Service of Northern Ireland, or the PSNI, who are the current police force in Northern Ireland today. The RUC were assisted by the Ulster Defence Regiment, or UDR, which was an infantry regiment of the British Army, which was established in 1970. It was composed of Northern Irish individuals, and though there were some Catholics there at the start, the regiment soon became mostly Protestant. The UDR focused their efforts on combating the IRA, and the IRA also focused their attacks on UDR barracks, as well as targeting the members in their homes when they were off duty. Many members of the unionist paramilitary organisation, the Ulster Volunteer Force, secretly infiltrated the UDR so that they could steal weapons, intelligence, and to learn training methods. At the height of the conflict, the British Army deployed around 21,000 soldiers into Northern Ireland in what became known as Operation Banner. They were responsible for around 10% of the total deaths in the Troubles. They were generally hated by Northern Irish Catholics, as Catholic areas were constantly subjected to house raids, checkpoints, patrols, and curfews. Then, when Bloody Sunday occurred in 1972, their relationship with the Catholic community was completely shattered. There have been a number of reports suggesting that some members of the British Army colluded with Loyalist paramilitaries. An Garda Síochána are the police force in the Republic of Ireland. They operated in the Republic and did not police Northern Ireland. They did assist in the tracking down of members of the IRA who were living or hiding out in the Republic of Ireland. That being said, there have also been allegations that there was collusion between An Garda Síochána and the IRA.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz.
And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you like true crime, celebrities, or conspiracies, this story is for you. Remember where you were at mentally and emotionally during the pandemic? Now imagine you're being hacked, stalked, and manipulated by someone or something so powerful that it becomes a federal case. That's what happened to me. The Final War Podcast. Out now on all available platforms.
Now, onto paramilitary organizations. Starting with the nationalist ones. In the mid-50s to the early 60s, the IRA had launched a border campaign against Northern Ireland, which involved guerrilla warfare-style attacks and the attacking of military and infrastructural targets close to the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. The campaign was largely seen as a failure and fizzled out in 1962. Throughout the 1960s, the IRA itself became heavily influenced by left-wing thinkers, and a split began to emerge between the older members and the younger members. Some members of the IRA maintained socialist beliefs, and others were unhappy at how the IRA had failed to protect Catholics during the rioting in 1969. This split in ideology would eventually lead to the fragmenting of the IRA in 1969 into the official IRA and the Provisional IRA. The official IRA did have an armed campaign in Northern Ireland, but a ceasefire was called in 1972, whereas the Provisional IRA were the main nationalist paramilitary group in the Troubles. The IRA was responsible for around half the deaths that occurred throughout the Troubles, which was a mixture of civilians, loyalists, and a large number of British soldiers. They were called the Provisional IRA, as the word provisional was intended to be a placeholder, but the word stuck and that became their known name. The Provisional IRA continued their campaign up until the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in 1999. Some members disagreed with the ceasefire and split from the group, going on to form the Real IRA, who are still active today, but to a much lesser extent. There is also a group known as the Continuity IRA, who are also still active, but in a much smaller way. There was another nationalist paramilitary group called the Irish National Liberation Army, or the INLA for short. They were established in 1974, and their aims were to remove Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom and to create a socialist republic encompassing all of Ireland. The INLA were responsible for 110 known deaths during the Troubles, and were a lot smaller than the Provisional IRA, but equally as devastating in some of their bombings and assassinations. They officially ended their armed campaign in 2009. Another nationalist organisation that played a small role was the Irish People's Liberation Organisation, who waged attacks on members of the INLA as well as unionists. Now for some of the loyalist paramilitary organisations that were involved in the Troubles. Unionists were concerned about the rising tide of nationalism in Northern Ireland, and in 1966, a small group of individuals gathered together and formed the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF for short. The UVF were the largest loyalist paramilitary organisation to form during the Troubles. Their main aim was to combat Irish republicanism, and in particular the IRA. That being said, over two-thirds of their victims were Irish Catholic civilians. They also extended their campaign into the Republic of Ireland, attacking Dublin and Monaghan. Their armed campaign officially ended in 2007. In 1971, another paramilitary group, the Ulster Defence Association, was founded out of a coalition of loyalist militants who had been active since August 1969. Though they were called the UDA, they went by the cover name the Ulster Freedom Fighters to avoid the UDA getting outlawed. They were responsible for a number of random attacks against Catholics. Though the UDA and the UVF had a common enemy in the IRA, they often clashed with each other, but usually managed to maintain an uneasy truce throughout the Troubles. There are many other loyalist paramilitary organisations, including the Ulster Protestant Volunteers, the Red Hand Commandos, Ulster Resistance, the Loyalist Volunteer Force, and Protestant Action Force. These groups all took part in sectarianism violence during the Troubles. It's easy to see why the Troubles can be so difficult to learn about. So many of these paramilitary organisations had similar but different aims, and continued to splinter whenever there was an internal disagreement or power struggle. Now, I'll explain some of the political parties that were active during the Troubles. The Social Democratic and Labour Party is a nationalist political party that was established in 1970 and had a heavy focus on Irish reunification. It's a political party that completely rejects violence, and they were essential throughout the 90s in talks that would eventually lead to the Good Friday Agreement and tentative peace in Northern Ireland. They are currently the third largest political party in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin are next. They were considered the political wing of the IRA, and because of this, they had difficulty making progress in the political world. They were seen as a thinly veiled terrorist organisation, and in many cases, unionists and the British government refused to engage in talks with them unless the IRA agreed to decommission their weapons, which means to destroy their weapons. In 1975, Gerry Adams and a number of others drew up long-term plans for Northern Ireland, which they called the Long War. Brian Feeney describes in his book that the plan was to stop any large-scale attacks and instead begin the War of the Flea, in which a never-ending tirade of guerrilla warfare would eventually wear the British forces down. It was around this time that a plan was set in motion to develop Sinn Féin as a political party, so that if a ceasefire was ever to happen, then there would be a political structure put in place to further the agenda. conscious effort was then made to separate the IRA from Sinn Féin. Many Irish people today still harbour resentment towards Sinn Féin, though there has been a growing surge in support for them in the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland over the past few years. Over the past 20 years, Sinn Féin has overtaken SDLP as the dominant nationalist party in Northern Ireland. Then, in 2020, the Republic of Ireland had a general election in which Sinn Féin rose up to find themselves part of a three-way split between themselves, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. On the Unionist side, the Ulster Unionist Party, or UUP, was the main political party who were active during the Troubles. They are a conservative, pro-unionist party that were the dominant party up until the Democratic Unionist Party overtook them in 2005. The Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, is another conservative, pro-unionist party that was founded by Ian Paisley during the Troubles. They would be considered more hardline than the UUP and would be a lot more reluctant to work with any nationalist parties. As of 2020, Arlene Foster is the first minister of the DUP and is currently power sharing with Sinn Féin under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. I'll now explain a short summary of what the Good Friday Agreement is. The Good Friday Agreement was the agreement that brought peace to Northern Ireland after three decades of violence. By the 90s, both the Nationalists and Unionists realised that the long war was unwinnable and something else needed to be put in place to put an end to this never-ending cycle of tit-for-tat violence. In 1996, talks began between the British government, the Irish government, and eight political parties in Northern Ireland. US President Bill Clinton also helped mediate these talks. A referendum was held in the Republic of Ireland and in Northern Ireland, who both voted in favour of the Good Friday Agreement. A power-sharing assembly was then established, and the larger paramilitary groups, such as the IRA and the UVF, committed to decommissioning their weapons. The release of prisoners was one of the most controversial terms of the agreement and caused outrage among the public. It stated that any prisoners who were serving time for crimes committed as part of paramilitary groups should be released, regardless of the severity of the crime committed. This is on the proviso that the paramilitary groups remain decommissioned and those released do not join any other groups. In this way, many people who had committed bombings and assassinations were released, and it is the reason that most episodes in this podcast end in the same way, with the individual being released under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. 143 people who were serving life sentences were released, and the Mays Prison, which was set up during the Troubles, was completely emptied over the course of a year. I'm going to finish with some statistics from the era. 3,466 people died during the 30-year period. Of that figure, 1,525 were Catholic and 1,250 were Protestant. 691 people who died were not from Northern Ireland. More than half of the people killed during the Troubles were civilians. The IRA is responsible for 1,696 of the deaths during the Troubles, which is about 49% of the total people killed. The UVF is responsible for 396 deaths, most of which are Catholic civilians. The British military is responsible for the deaths of 307 individuals, with 51% of those being civilians, and the rest being members of Republican paramilitary organisations. That's the end of this episode, and hopefully this has provided a basic introduction to the conflict in Northern Ireland. Please feel free to reach out with any questions that you have, and I'll probably do another podcast answering more questions in the next season.
Buenos dias, world, from the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance. I'm Marco Wendt.
And I'm Rick Schwartz. And we're your hosts for Season 3 of Amazing Wildlife, a show from iHeartRadio Ruby Studio and the global conservation organization behind the San Diego Zoo and the San Diego Zoo Safari Park.
Listen as we dive into the efforts here in San Diego and spotlight the heroes working worldwide to care for the species you know and love.
Listen to Amazing Wildlife on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.